The Florida community of mindfulness is happy to make these talks available to you. If you find this talk to be a benefit, please consider making a donation to support us. You'll find a donation button on the talks section of our website, floridamindfulness.org. Thank you, and may you be happy and free of suffering.
So this is the second day of this four-day retreat, entitled Stabilizing the Restless Mind, Practicing Mindfulness and Calm Abiding. Since that is what we've been practicing and that is what we've been talking about for nearly the last 2 days, hopefully everyone has a better sense of what these teachings and practices are about and how to do them. As well as by now, hopefully everyone has sort of settled into the life of being on retreat, especially for those of you who are somewhat new, kind of living with a schedule and being in a strange bed, so to speak, and new environment, and you know that we've kind of if there was any difficulty or challenges in the beginning, hopefully that is all behind us, and we can just enjoy being on retreat. As I said yesterday, we are here to practice these teachings of mindfulness and calm abiding. That is what we are here for. But what we are often experiencing has nothing to do with that. What we are experiencing is often our mind. Our mind states, the way we historically approach things, approach life, approach challenges, you know, just kind of the way we have lived. And so to think that that is something that we can not pay attention to, that is something we can sort of short circuit or go around or you know, repress or suppress or whatever is foolhardy. Because when we talk about transformation, right, and we call our community or the path we walk is the path of healing and transformation, well, what are we transforming? You know, transformation has an idea that we're taking something that's already form and changing the formation. Right? Transformation. And so it is this very mind of ours, unruly, right? Untrained, filled with all its own ideas about how to do things and how to not do things, full of its own emotions and afflictions and, you know what I'm talking about? You know, that's the very thing, it's not really a thing, that's going to be transformed, that we need to transform. You know, it's not something else. It is this very mind. Right? It is all your problems, all your issues, all your mind states. It is all this stuff that needs to be transformed. And it all can be. Because we understand that all the things that arise in our mind are only arising because of causes and conditions from our past. And if we change the causes and conditions and we change the way we relate to these things, you know, we have the power to heal and transform, to change. I mean, that's what, I'll just speak for Buddhism, that's what all what Buddhism is about. From the Buddha until today. The Buddha was an ordinary person who woke up, transformed, healed, and became the Buddha. He probably still looked like he looked when he was in the palace. So he didn't look any different. What it transformed was his mind and his relationship to the phenomena of his mind. He had wisdom, he had understanding. And therefore he was able to, within the same body, within the same two arms and two legs and all the sense organs that all of us have, he was able to completely transform that process. That's all that happened. That all that does happen. Now, many of us have jumped right into the process of changing ourselves, improving ourselves, right? Some of us have been at it for decades. And perhaps, your entrance in the Florida Community of Mindfulness is just the latest chapter in the long history of self-improvement, okay? Now, the unique thing about Buddhism, it says, before you jump, see, we've always just jumped in, right? We just jump into it with very incomplete understanding of the full picture. So in Buddhism, we say, slow down. Slow down. You know, let's just slow this process down in both a conceptual way, studying Dharma, so we kind of get the bigger picture of what's going on, you know, and why certain actions are wholesome and non-wholesome, why, you know, how afflictive mind states are created, how positive mind states are created, what this mind's about, you know what I mean, to try to, get an understanding, conceptual understanding. But most importantly, it has these practices that we're doing here, which says, before you jump into transformation and healing, let things settle down so you can see clearly, right? Because oftentimes we jump into the problem of ourself from what viewpoint? The viewpoint of our neurotic, confused self. Like the neurotic, confused, delusional self says, I am going to change myself. Right? And you wonder why it kind of hasn't worked. It's not from effort. It's not from trying. It's just because, you know, we don't have a clue of how to really go about it. And we don't have, you know, it's like I said yesterday. You know, if I want to see clearly what's going on around me, the first thing I got to do is clean my glasses. Right? Then I can look around. But as long as I'm wearing dirty glasses, which I happen to be wearing right now, by the way, noticing that, you know, it's not all for naught, but it's just more confusion. So we want some clarity of mind, some stability of mind. And the teachings and practices of mindfulness and samatha are the way we do it. Now, Thich Nhat Hanh, he calls samatha, the practice of samatha, which traditionally is called calm abiding or mental tranquility meditation, he calls it simply stopping. Stopping. We need to stop. Stop what we're doing. Stop endlessly doing the same thing. Stop and let things settle. You know, he uses the example that this kind of meditation, what we're doing is stopping and letting, you know, the sediment that's all been stirred up by our constant doing, to settle. Right? And he uses the example, and you probably heard it, you know, where he says, you know, if you're walking into the lake and you want to see to the bottom, right, stop walking. You know, if you keep walking, you're just going to keep stirring the sediment up and you're never going to see the bottom. And you think maybe the problem is, oh, it's a cloudy lake. Right? No. The lake is pure. It's we're stirring things up. Right? And when you understand it, then you do what? Then you just stop. You be patient. And you let the sediment settle to the bottom. And then you can look around to see what's there. Right? The process of looking around to see what's there, we call insight meditation. Okay? But the reason some degree of samatha is needed first is, you know, as long as the water is all muddy, right? We won't see clearly, and it'll just be very difficult. Now, there's a concept that comes from Chinese Chan, Chinese Zen, and you've heard me, some of you probably talk about this before, where mind is called the host. And all the things that arise in the mind are called the guests. And this is important to understand, because for many of us at this point, we have that confused. Right? See, we think all the guests are me. We think all the thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories that are rising in my mind are me. So we give them an incredible amount of importance and identification. Is that clear? But if you're a host, if you're the host, you know when your guests come that they're the guests, right? And one of the things that defines the difference between a host and a guest is the host stays and the guests leave. Everybody understand what I'm talking about? Okay. The host is that which stays. The guests are those that come and go. And when you know that, you can even be put up with some fairly unpleasant guests. Because you know what? They're going to leave. They're leaving, right? They're not part of the furniture. It's just temporary, right? Now, how you deal with the guests, especially the unpleasant guests, is something else. But this fundamental knowledge has a lot to do with how you relate, right? And the problem is we do not know the difference between host and guests. It is confused. We don't know, even conceptually, that our mind nature is sort of this empty, spacious awareness in which things are endlessly arising. Right? Our basic mind is just this fundamental capacity we have to be aware. Right? We are aware of things we see. We are aware of sounds we hear. We are aware of things we smell. We are aware of things we taste. We are aware of the things we feel in our body. We are aware of thoughts when we're aware of thoughts and feelings and emotions and memories. Is that clear? All of that is arising in mind. In awareness, right? And so to keep that analogy going, this mind, basic mind awareness, is the host. Identify with the host. But most people, if not everyone, identifies with who? The guests. Right? And they're endlessly coming and going. And they have no stability. Right? Some guests just show up anytime they want. You probably know people like that. They don't even call in advance. Right? They're just knocking at the door. Hello? Right? No. I say, don't answer the door. You know? If you peek out and you see who's there and you go, mm-mm, don't answer the door. If you answer the door, you only have one person to blame. Is that true? Right? They can't help themselves. Right? They're just showing up for whatever reason they're showing up. But we're the one, you know, at the door. And we're the one looking through the people. And we, you know, we need to understand clearly they're the guests and I have some freedom in how I relate to the guests. Now, that's a very nice concept, right? And maybe all of you are going, oh, now I get it. Well, but to get it, really get it, means you get it in your meditation. Because in meditation, we are experiencing that directly. It's very clear. We sit. We sit in mindfulness. We sit in awareness. We sit in concentration. Is that true? That is what we're trying to do. And as we're doing that, what happens? At the same time that we're trying to do that, what happens? What do you notice is happening all the time? Guests are showing up. Welcome guests. Yeah, but sometimes, you know, we welcome them, right? Sometimes we welcome them in. What? We entertain them, yeah. And then we wonder why they keep coming back. Good point, Jacqueline. Yeah, good point. Right? Yeah. I mean, if you treat your guests really nicely, you know, they're going to want to keep coming back. Right? Don't blame them. Right? Stop being such a good host. Okay? So, in meditation, we maybe for many of us have the first time to really see clearly what we don't see in our daily life. Because in our daily life, it's just happening, right? And we're just bouncing around. You know, that's called the monkey mind. You know, the monkey, like the monkeys in the zoo, they're jumping around, right? Have you ever seen them? They're swinging here and swinging there and they're looking there and looking there and they're fighting with each other and just, you know, right? Just having a great time. But they're just monkey mind. They're just all over the place, right? Which is probably very normal for a monkey, right? And they seem to do it quite well. But our mind, when our mind is jumping around in all directions, following everything it sees, everything it smells, everything it tastes, you know, reacting to everything that's going on in the environment, and, you know, reacting to everything that's going on in the internal environment, we might call about our thoughts, our feelings, our perceptions, our memories. When we're constantly reacting like that, there's no insight. There's no clarity, right? There's no even capacity to assess what's going on. Because why? Because we're lost in it, right? And it seems so normal. So the first rule is what? Stop. Samatha. Is that clear? That's what we're doing here. Now, you know, can we come to a complete stop? In a 30-minute meditation period every day in our daily life, even in a 4-day retreat, can we come to a complete stop? No. Maybe some can who have a very strong concentrated mind. For most of us, no. But we can come enough of a stop. Right? You know, there is a difference between driving at 20 miles an hour and driving at 80 miles an hour. Right? So we need to stop enough. We need to let the sediment settle down enough so we can begin to look around at the terrain of thoughts, feelings, perceptions, what's coming in, what's going out, what's wholesome, what's unwholesome. Right? I mean, you know, maybe tomorrow we'll talk about, you know, this retreat is stabilizing the restless mind, remember? Well, when the mind begins to experience its innate capacity to be calm and to rest, from that vantage point, to look around and begin, you'll see much more clearly what disturbs it. You know? You see? If your ability to try to figure out what disturbs it is always going on within the monkey mind rat race, you know, things will not be clear. And it's much more difficult. And it's also just, you know, that's just part of the drama. You know, I mean, even if you get a little insight into yourself, you won't be able to act on it with any consistency. Why not? Because you don't have mindfulness. Right? You don't have the capacity to consistently sustain something in your mind over time so it can really take effect. Right? So that's why many of us are even our attempts at changing. Something we know, right? You know, it's like how many of us say, I know better. Or, you know, I mean, I've been through this 10,000 times. I can't believe I'm doing it again. Well, why are we doing it again? Because that insight that we have, that somehow this is not healthy, this is not wholesome, this causes suffering to myself and others, we're unable to sustain it because we don't have that energy of a mind, that consistency of mind, right? And so where do we develop that? Well, one of the simple ways to develop is on the cushion, right? In a four-day retreat, we can begin to get some energy, get some capacity of follow through, right? When we drop it, we pick it up, right? Usually in our life, when we drop it, you know, it's not the 3 days later that we remember, oh, I dropped it, or 2 hours later, you know, what was I supposed to be focusing on? What was I supposed to be concentrating on? What was that insight I had this morning? You know, I was going to take into my life today, right? Because we don't have that capacity to hold things over any kind of time frame. So, you know, this practice, so again, this practice that we're learning here, where we concentrate on something, where we set an intention for something, and we learn to hold it throughout the day or throughout a meditation period. And when we drop it, we learn to stop and pick it up again, right? And then drop it, and then we pick it up again. You see, it becomes, all of a sudden, over time, it becomes it's like a mental habit that's a good one. Oh, we get it now. I know how to do that. So even if I get lost for a moment, I know how to get back on track. See, many of us don't know how to get back on track, do we? And we think that's a failure. It's not a failure. It's just a lack of a certain skill. What's the skill? Mindfulness. Sati. Sati has this quality of remembering, not forgetting. Right? Oh, I'm supposed to be I'm supposed to be counting 1 to 21. Completely out of my mind. I was just, I was thinking about lunch. You know what I mean? It's like, Sati. I remember. Oh. That's great. You have sati. You have mindfulness now. Good. And the more every day, every year you cultivate it, it gets stronger. It's a skill that comes from practice. So I mean, is this clear? And again, the things we talked about last time, like laziness and discouragement and self-esteem issues and all those kinds of things, lack of trust, lack of faith, all these things are just add-ons, you see, which just make the practice more difficult. We have, each of us has our stuff, right? You know what your stuff is. And we bring it to life. We think it's in life. No, we bring it to life. I often say to people, no, there's nothing to be dissatisfied about. It's in you. You have the seeds of dissatisfaction that are always looking for something to be dissatisfied about. You know, there are people who have the seeds inside themselves of discouragement, right? And so they think, oh, it's because of that situation that I'm feeling discouraged. No, that situation is just that situation. You're bringing the seeds of discouragement and projecting them onto that. But if your mind isn't clear, if you can't see that that's all that's going on, right? That this, the seeds of discouragement, the mind states of discouragement have arisen in me, not out there, in me. And it's an unhealthy mind state. That's all it is. It is not endemic to the mind. The mind is pure and vast and open and spacious and just aware. It doesn't have issues. What has issues? The self has issues. The I, me, my has issues. Lots of issues, depending on how much it's issue-oriented. But the mind itself in its nature has no issues at all. It just flows along from moment to moment, aware, present. Right? That's why I was saying yesterday, that's one of the things we need to trust. Even though that's not our experience yet, from hearing the teachings, reading the teachings, oh, that is my mind nature. And every now and then you'll have a little touch of it, right? You know, the mind will just come to a rest, right? There'll be nothing going on, but there'll be awareness, and you'll feel at peace. Right? Not for any reason other than you're just resting in your mind, not doing anything, and the mind's at peace. Where is that peace coming from? It's coming from its own nature. Our minds are at peace, right? You know, we say, the leaves are moving, but it's the wind that's moving the leaves. It looks like the leaves are moving, but it's the wind that's moving the leaves. It's these winds of our karmic conditioning that's endlessly moving our mind around, blowing it this way and that way. Any questions about this? Yes.
You talk about impermanence. I'm just wondering if...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Are impermanent.
Yes. So the question was referring to what we in Buddhist psychology call the storehouse consciousness, where the seeds of all our experience are. It probably somewhat relates, but it's sort of different to what we might call the unconscious. It's a part of our mind we're not conscious of, but yet holds the seeds of everything. Yeah, they're all impermanent. They're seeds. Right? Seeds just are an entity unto themselves that only have the capacity or the power of that specific seed, right? A seed of a palm tree, a palm seed, will not grow an oak tree, right? It can only grow a palm, right? Right? Every seed only has the potential of its own conditioning. And so when we either stop cultivating those seeds, or we transform those seeds, or we stop putting those seeds in the ground or whatever of our consciousness, they will not be there. Right? I mean, is that clear? I mean, even if you have bare ground, you think, oh, maybe some of you who've gardened, you've had this experience where you kind of clean the garden and you go, oh, wow, beautiful, no weeds. And then you notice over the coming weeks, things are growing. Well, is it a miracle? Right? I mean, you start calling your friends, there's a miracle going on in my garden. There was nothing there and all these things are just appearing. Right? No, it's not a miracle. The seeds were still in the earth. Right? The roots were still in the earth. They had not been taken out. And so therefore, when there was moisture, when there was heat, when there were, they grew. It's just like that. I mean, it's not a mystical process. It's not an esoteric process. It's very practical, very real. And so the process of transformation, we can go about it, with absolute confidence and certainty. That's all, I have been conditioned, my mind has been conditioned because of causes and conditions from the past. That is all. And these causes and conditions have left seeds and impressions within my storehouse consciousness. Right? That's all. Now, from this moment on, if when these seeds or experiences or formations from my past arise, I handle them skillfully, wisely, so they don't continue to grow and empower themselves and develop. And at the same time, I'm very consciously cultivating only wholesome seeds. It's like gardening, right? You know, it's like, yeah, you want to pull out the stuff you want to pull out, but the main thing is like, what do you want to plant, right? I mean, gardening can't just be about weeding. Right? I mean, gardening has to be about the flowers and the vegetables and the things you want to grow, the things that are nourishing and beautiful. I mean, that's the emphasis. But we also, again, depending on our karmic load, some of us, you know, have a heavy-duty karmic load. There's only affliction. I'm just taking an extreme. Okay? So then we have to do a lot of careful pruning and whatever to make some room. Okay? That's all. Right? You know, but many of us, I think, are more mixed. We already have areas of our mind where we can grow some nutritious, beautiful things already. And just over time, we extend that and, begin to lessen the amount of space in our garden where the weeds grow. And over time, if we're consistent, we will one day have a very beautiful garden. And that will be the primary thing growing in it. It doesn't mean every now and then we don't have to do some weeding, do some pruning. But it's not like it is in the beginning. I mean, it's as simple as that. But as we've said, there's a complexity to our minds that we can't believe it can be so simple. Right? Because we think what? Wow, I'm a very complicated person. Right? And we say that quite proudly. Whew. I mean, like, nobody's as screwed up as I am. You know what I mean? Like, it's almost like a... right? I mean, and when we have to realize that when we talk that way about ourselves, we are reinforcing that belief within us, which, of course, is not, you know... I mean, if I say, no, this piece of land can never be made into something beautiful. Right? Right? No, impossible. Well, then what kind of effort are we going to make? You see? And we don't realize that it's the way we've conceived, you know, the project is creating our response to what needs to be done. That's all. Another person looking at that same plot of land will go, oh, wow, what potential there. You know, I just got to do this, and this. That's all. Can you see, looking at the same plot of land, but very different mind states? And I think that's very much, you know, what goes on in human beings. You know, and some of us are on this end of the continuum, some of us on this end of the continuum, most of us are in the middle. But confidence in the path, confidence in the teaching, confidence in the teacher, confidence in the methodology, you know, helps us get over our own limitations, our own mind of doubt, our own mind of discouragement, you know. Is that clear, especially for those people who have that kind of mind? It's just a mind state. And something, because you've believed it and acted on it, it seems to have some truth to it, but it's not. Yes.
So if we look at it from a physiological point of view, concepts moving from subconscious to conscious gets reinforced and we build maybe more neural pathways, which results in our brain shifting more towards positive or negative thought patterns.
Sounds good. Yeah. So, what is your first name again?
Orhan was just sharing from a more neurological point of view.
Questioning.
You know, I'm not a neurologist. Actually, he's not here, but we have a member who's Gunther's here. Maybe Gunther, Maria, we can, afterwards you can talk to him. All right, Gunther, he's our scientist over there. But, yeah, yes, Tammy. Can we talk about, that's a wonderful question. Can we talk about it tomorrow? No, I want to talk. In other words, I mean, that's where we're going, but I'd like to have another day of just mindfulness practice so our minds are just more settled and clearer. Because, yeah, that's, I mean, it's like I've said, that's the journey, right? I mean, the whole reason, you know, that we cultivate meditation and mindfulness introspection. So, in our daily life, our real life, so to speak. You know, we can be freer of negative emotions and have more positive emotions. So I want to deal with that. Just give me another day, okay? Okay. And catch me tomorrow, okay? No, I appreciate that. Yes, Gunther.
Yeah. And the reason why I'm asking this is because these are mostly the situations that are not having reacted to.
Say that again. The last thing you said, because these are the.
These are perceived danger, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Lashing out. Not in our society, perceived danger is the real danger.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, so the question is, is this kind of, I'll just put it in my own words, this kind of deeply inbred historical reactivity that many of us have cultivated in different ways, is it possible to really transform that, change that? Now, again, I would say yes. Now, I mean, I was interested in how I took your first question, which is it even possible, even for these very prime, like the survival mechanism, you know, in a real, and we know from the accounts of great meditators for centuries that they talk about living. I mean, I was recently reading the biography of Achan Chah, who was a very famous forest-dwelling master in Thailand. Who has passed, and he talks about, you know, living in the jungle with tigers and lions, you know what I mean? You know, and really, and how you can get to a place where there's basically no reactivity, even from normal reactivity. So, you know, so can one's meditation be so strong and so inward that one basically has kind of severed kind of ties to even one's sense organs? And again, this is not my experience, but they say yes. Now again, that is not a constant state. You know, all their reporting is in a specialized environment where they just keep going deeper and deeper and deeper into the mind, they can basically lose that connection temporarily. You know, and it's usually like a trance state. I guess that's another way to put it. It's like a trance state. But I think you're talking about something more mundane, right? Yeah, because I think the key thing is what you said, you know, our perception of danger. I think there's the liberating piece to acknowledge there's a perception, and the perception's arising in my mind, right? It's not arising out there. It's arising in my mind, and we know that anything that arises in my mind is just an empty concept. It has no solidity, right? And so if you ask me, can either by a deep meditation that actually unpacks the empty nature of all our perceptions, or and or at a more cognitive level, you know, reshifting, rechanging the perception. Because again, the perception we have of danger when there's really no danger is something that we have developed, often unconsciously, right? Because of things that have happened and the way we responded unconsciously to them, reactivity. So if you ask me, yes, can deeply embedded patterns of response, you know, we call that reactivity. There's no, as opposed to, we might say, responsive, where there is some sort of conscious response, but we're talking about sort of an immediate reactivity. Yeah, I think that could be changed, but one has to be very conscious and directive about that, you know, like, and I think that often happens as one goes on in one's practice. You know, I think in the early stages of our practice, you know, the first 200 years or so, you know, we're you know, it's sort of like there's a lot to deal with. You know, it's not like the whole thing's sort of a mess, and just to kind of sort things out, you know, and focus on the on the most difficult stuff first, you know, is often what happens. But over time, as things sort of settle down and we're not so bounced around, then I think it often becomes clearer what are these kind of deeper patterns of reactivity that just really very much have a life of their own and are very spontaneous, you know. They just, like you say, happen. So again, I think at that point, because you know what they are, you know, one can bring conscious awareness to that, both you know, as things arise, so your perceptions of things are clearer, but also, you know, when one can practice in one's mind. You know, I mean, one sort of knows the situations. And talking about neural pathways, of which I know absolutely nothing, but, you know, neural pathways are pathways that are conditioned within our brain, right, by experience. And the brain is not very good at discerning reality. I mean, whatever it processes, it processes. So, you know, involving oneself even in an imaginary situation that elicits all the responses also is a way to work on it. Okay? I want to work for a bit from a text. And some of you are familiar with this text called The Way of the Bodhisattva, Shantideva. It's a much, much loved text for me, and I've taught it 3 or 4 times at intensives over the years, so they're probably... several people here who are familiar with Shantideva and this path of the Bodhisattva. He was an 8th century Indian, a great Buddhist scholar and practitioner who wrote this text, The Way of the Bodhisattva. And it's really one of the great teachings, all in verse, by the way. It's really a verse poem on really the, you know, the path of awakening from beginning to end. It's called The Way of the Bodhisattva. Shantideva, 8th century Indian. And it's based on the Paramitas. Again, we won't go into that. So this is chapter 5. And it's the translator translated it as vigilant introspection. Traditionally, this Paramita is the Paramita of Virya, which is energy. So it's really talking about the energy, the mind energy we bring to our introspection, right? Again, like we were saying earlier, and again, I'm not a linguist, but, you know, there's inspection and there's introspection. And it would seem that introspection is my more internal, while inspection is perhaps more external. And so introspection is just another word for when we are now examining our own mind, our own experience, right? When we are, you know, observing and judging and assessing everybody else's, let's call that inspection. And many of us, unfortunately, spend most of our time inspecting the behavior and the mind state of others. But in this path, we want to begin to introspect. Right? We are examining our own minds, our own experience, our own emotions, our own response patterns. Is that clear? Introspection. So he's calling it vigilant introspection. And this is, again, in verses. So we'll see how far we get. So he begins, those who wish to keep the trainings must, with perfect self-possession, guard their minds. Without the guard upon the mind, the trainings cannot be preserved. Okay, so this sounds a little bit like what we've been talking about the last couple of days. This is 8th century India. Okay, a long time ago. Totally different culture, and yet same issues in meditation. Is that clear? So don't think that somehow, we have unique challenges. In a certain way, I mean, the minds have changed, but the fundamentals of how we go about this process of transformation is the same. For those who wish to keep the trainings. And we could just interpret trainings means anything you want to train in, okay? Anything you want to train in. Those who wish to keep the trainings must with perfect self-possession guard their minds. Without this guard upon the mind, the trainings cannot be preserved. This is very important. This is the first statement. Because if you ask yourself, and everybody just close their eyes a second and ask yourself, do I have a guard upon my mind? I mean, have I even thought about hiring a guard? Or does my mind just, open to anything? I mean, this is profound, and I think it's a reason why he begins here. If you want to keep the trainings, if you want to persevere in anything, we must have a guard upon our minds. Okay? What does a guard do? Keep out the bad, but let in. Yeah, this is important. Right? Right? You see, I mean, this is important. You know, we want a guard that does both, right? But there's somebody there, at the gate, at the door going, yeah, you can come in. No, you can't come in. Without a guard, if there's no guard at the gate, if there's no guard at the door, what's going to happen? Well, anybody can come. Good guess, bad guess, indifferent guess. Dangerous guess, loving, it's all wide open. Now, if this sounds like what's been going on with you for most of this life, all right, don't get discouraged. Realize, oh, no wonder. Right? No wonder all those people in gated communities have a guard at the gate. Oh, now I get it. You have to have spent many years in Naples to understand that one. Right? No offense to people. but it is something we learn very clearly living in Naples, which I lived for 25 years. Yeah. So. Second verse. Wandering where it will, the elephant of mind will bring us down to torment. I mean, Shantideva, he's very strong. And he's steeped in a kind of worldview that may be familiar to us. Here we are at a Catholic retreat center. Of course, it's what it used to be, where hell realms, were very much part of the culture. People believed in these things, many realms. So wandering where it will, the elephant of mind will bring us down to torment in the hell of unrelenting pain. No worldly beast, however wild and crazed, could bring upon us such calamities. Okay. So he uses the example of the mind like an elephant. Now, an elephant in India is a very powerful example because of all the animals, and you know, it was a culture where there were lots of animals, not just domesticated, but wild animals everywhere still. The elephant was the biggest, the strongest. In a certain sense, when the elephants went wild, it could be most dangerous, right? Most destructive. So he calls it the elephant of mind, right? Wandering where it will, it can even bring us down into the torment of a hell of unrelenting pain. There may be some of us in this room who said, "Oh, I've been there." Okay, not as a geographic place, but as a mental place. We know. Yeah, I've been that place. We're close to that place, or maybe one of the ante rooms of that place. And he's just using that as an example. That's saying this mind, elephant of mind, left to its own devices, can just run amok, and who knows where it'll take us. And again, so if you kind of use that as an analogy for all afflictive mind states, he's saying, you know, is there anything else that really has the power to cause us such suffering? Right? Than my own mind. Again, we often think that our sufferings are caused by others. But he's saying, no, really, the most dangerous animal, so to speak, that we face is the crazed elephant of our own mind. If, third verse, if with mindfulness's rope, the elephant of mind is tethered all around, our fears will come to nothing, and every virtue will drop into our hands. Okay, so this is important. You know, he's making it, remember I was saying yesterday, you need to be convinced that the methodology works and will deliver for you. So he's saying, yeah, even this powerful elephant, if tethered by mindfulness, will, you know, all our worst fears about life will come to naught. And every virtue, every goodness, every positive thing can come to us. Right? But as long as this elephant is running amok, right, that will never happen. You know, again, if anybody has seen pictures or anything, you know, of an elephant stampede in Africa or India, you know, when these guys run amok, it is dangerous. I mean, they just go through villages, knocking over everything. They go through fields and they just destroy everything. Right? They just run amok. So, you know, he's using verbiage that's very real to people. You know, they understand that. It's a little distant from us, but... So we need... Now again, when we hear tether, you know, that doesn't mean the elephant's got to be tightly bound, right? The elephant doesn't have to be tightly bound, but it has to be, you know, in the beginning, there has to be a chain. Some chain, right, that holds it. Now, and if you've ever been to India, you see, you know, once the elephant is trained, you know, this little guy can be on top, you know, the mahout can be up top and will follow the elephant, right? Or it's like if you've ever been to Southeast Asia, you see these quite large water buffaloes, right? I mean, they're quite big, you know. And you see little kids, you know, 5 and 6 years old, you know, riding them along, and the buffalo, you know, will follow them, will listen to them, because they've been trained. But also, if you look closely, oftentimes there's a little ring through the bull's nose, and it's connected to a little rope. So if the bull does begin to go this way or that, you know, if it's not trained, they give it a little tug. Mindfulness is rope. That's all. And again, mindfulness meaning the mindfulness that knows where we are. It's clear to what's going on right now. And it remembers. In this case, it remembers what's wholesome and what's not wholesome. Right? Or like the guard, you know? Who's on the list to come in and who's not on the list. Is that clear? You know, that's all you need. Right? You don't need, you know, it doesn't say an arm guard. It doesn't say an army. Just a guard, right? Somebody there that can check IDs, can identify positive and negative, wholesome and unwholesome, good or bad, wanted, unwanted. Is that clear? And again, we need to ask ourselves, do I have that kind of guard on my gate, on the gate of my mind? You know, is there a part of me that has that presence of mind, that self-awareness, that is just simply aware of what's arising in my mind? Right? And if it's wholesome, if it's good, if it's benign, it's okay. But if it's not wholesome, if it's toxic, if it's destructive, right? I mean, is that clear? I mean, many of us endlessly ruminate about things from the past. You know, could have been just 10 minutes ago. Could have been years ago. Where that rumination is fundamentally a source of suffering to us. Right? And yet, there's nothing inside us that goes, you're causing suffering to yourself. Stop. See how simple that is? That little bit of self-aware. That's the guard. That's mindfulness. It's mindfulness that tethers the elephant. Okay. So don't think you have to bind it. You know, like it's like that kind of thing. See, many people think, you know, they got to struggle with their dark self. Got to struggle with their... No, if you're struggling with it, you're going to lose. Right? It's an elephant. Right? Right, I mean, you also see in India that they, you know, they just tie one of the legs of the elephant. Just one leg, that's all. You don't have to tie the whole thing. By the simple binding of this mind alone, all things are likewise bound. By simple taming of this mind alone, all these things are likewise tamed. This is very important. Many of us are struggle within ourselves, with our thoughts, our feelings, our memories, right? You know, the all of it, right? Is we deal with it sort of case by case, you know.
case by case, situation by situation. You know, how do I react here? How do I respond here? What do I do here? Which is a lot of work. And you think you need a lot of skills. But he's saying, by simply binding the mind alone, all the issues and problems of the mind are bound. Why is that? Because everything that is arising, all your thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories, afflictions, whatever, are all arising where? In the mind. Oh! So if I learn how to work, tame, train my mind, everything is taken care of. Is that true, Chris? Okay. A little quizzical look on your face. All right. I mean, is that clear? So that's why this is a mind skill. It's sort of like we were talking yesterday. You know, if you're going to the gym because you want to become stronger, right? Well, that strength you develop, you can use anywhere, right? You can use to lift things, to go for long walks, to open jars, you know. You know what I mean? I mean, you see what I'm saying? It's you have bodily strength now, and you can do whatever you can use it in endless ways. And once you have the strength of mind, this mindfulness, you can use it in all situations. So this is why this practice of mindfulness, you know, again, it's just interesting because in our culture, you know, mindfulness, even, you know, nothing to do with Buddhism, but just mindfulness, you know, is very much in the culture these days. But yet you can see, and this is, you know, 8th century text, and it goes back to the time of the Buddha, that actually mindfulness has a centrality, right? To the whole kind of human life. You know, this awareness that without this mindfulness, without this guard at the gate, you know, that it's incredibly difficult to not, lead a very up and down, back and forth, happy, sad, afflicted, you know, just because it's just a wild elephant just stampeding around. For all anxiety and fear and pain in boundless quantity, their source and wellspring is the mind itself, as he who spoke the truth declared. He's referring to the Buddha. So again, I mean, if there are any like cardinal principles that as followers of this path, to whatever degree, you know, whether we're going for full enlightenment and total liberation, or just we just want a calmer, stabler mind, or we just want to be a nicer person, you know, whatever, whatever your aspiration, it can only be attained truly through the practice of mindfulness. Because the basis of all these qualities, positive and negative, arise only in the mind. And if there's anything we need to kind of get, we need to get that. If there's anything we need to get that everything is arising in mind. And so if we want to change how we are, how we feel, how we react, we have to do that introspectively within our mind. We have spent most of our life trying to change the outer circumstances and the people in order to create a mind state within ourselves, right? To feel safe, to feel secure, to feel happy, to feel loved. You know, all to feel worthy. You know, always we have looked to external circumstances, and by controlling them, that somehow we can create the mind state we seek. Buddhism goes the other way. It doesn't
deny that, you know, that we're not affected by the world and we don't respond to the world, but it understands that all mind states are of the mind. And mindfulness, meditation, insight, introspection are all ways, are all tools that we can use to transform the mind, understand the mind, clarify the mind, calm the mind. This is why the centrality of the meditative path is so essential, you know, for really psychological well-being in the truest sense. I mean, are there any questions about that? Yes, Maria.
It with a garden, one can have a very beautiful garden, but if you go away for a couple of months, you know, the garden can instantly, even if you have a gardener, so to say, you think, oh, it's in a way taken care of, you come back from a very real experience. I talk in both ways, you know, and the bougainvillea is all mildewy, and the plants, they have lice. It's like, the gardener did only part of the work, and the hedge looks beautiful, the grass looks beautiful, but some areas are just totally overlooked, and it is a constant process of maintenance and of processing and work in that sense.
Yeah, but again, as I was trying to say earlier, I think, yeah, so this is for the... Yes, for the recording. Yeah, so Maria is kind of continuing with the gardening analogy and from her own experience and just saying, yeah, I mean, it has to be a gardener who's attending to everything. And it has to be consistent. Now, again, the good news is, right, the good news is, Maria, is that it's more work in the beginning. It's more work in the beginning when we don't have the gardening skills yet. It's more work in the beginning when, you know, the garden's just out of control, right? So we might say, there's more work, okay? But over time, as you develop your skills in gardening and as in time you select the right plants, and hopefully they're not high-maintenance plants, we want to get over the high-maintenance stuff. Right? Low maintenance, just consistent, and, you know, zero escape, you know, doesn't need too much watering, too much attention, you know, but yet needs tending. Over time, it'll become more like that. Okay. So it's a process. You know, again, in the beginning, it's more work, you know what I mean, to learn the skills and get the garden just we want, the right plant, and, you know, and which ones we work. But over time, once you kind of get that down, it's just a matter of, you know, tending it. You know, and that can be a pleasure. It doesn't have to be a lot of work. Any other questions about what's been read so far? Good. And so he says, harmful beings are everywhere like space itself. Impossible it is that they should all be suppressed. But let this angry mind be overthrown, and it's as though all the foes have been subdued. And then this very famous analogy where he says, to cover all the earth with sheets of leather, where could such amounts of skin be found? But with leather soles of just my shoes, it is as though I cover all the earth. I mean, these are very famous lines of his. You know? As long as I think my anger is caused by them, as long as I think my anger is caused by the situation, you know, I will always have anger. Because we can't control people. And he says, harmful beings are everywhere.
I'll let you decide whether that's true or not, but there's certainly some truth to it. Again, acknowledging that there may be many people who see us as harmful. So it's not one-sided. But most people look out in the world and see foes, see enemies, see people in their way or wanting to do them harm. And either we go on a campaign to suppress them all, to beat them all, to convert them all, right? Like some people do. Or we realize this anger and this perception of a foe is arising in my own mind and nowhere else. If I can take care of that perception and that emotion within myself, then I'm free to go anywhere. And he uses, again, this wonderful, I think, very powerful analogy. You know, again, and the full analogy is, you know, if you could imagine the whole earth is covered by thorns. Right? We could gather sheets, here he says leather, you know, because we want to walk about on the earth, don't we? So one strategy is what? Let me cover the earth. Every square inch of the earth, and then I can walk around safely in my bare feet. One strategy. Or else, he says, I can just cover the soles of my feet. And then the thorns don't bother me, do they? It's sort of like, you know, I mean, what he left out was, you decide. You know, you decide what you want to do. Many of us have been on a project like that without even knowing it. If I could just cover the earth and all the people and all the circumstances of the earth, you know, then I can walk about easily and safely, right? Without any affliction, without. Calmly and peacefully. But not only is that a lot of work, but it is endless. So the analogy of let me protect my feet from the thorns. And of course the feet are the mind, right? And the leather or the shoe, the soul is, you know, mindfulness, the guard. Let there be something between me and the thorns of life that protects me, keeps me safe, keeps me from feeling pain. Right? I mean, we can, if we have good shoes, good boots, you know, we can walk on thorns, right? We can walk on rocky terrain and our feet won't hurt, will they? It's really wonderful, isn't it, to have a good pair of walking shoes. But if we are barefoot, that's very difficult. Struggle, painful. And again, I think that is, you know, again, I think it's a very powerful analogy for all of us to realize, no wonder kind of life hurts so much, right? You know, I thought it was me, or I thought it was just light, you know, I didn't have anything to protect me. I didn't have a barrier between me and the thorn, so they didn't strike. Is that clear? And that's an important kind of epiphany. Because if you've always walked about on thorn-covered ground, and somebody comes along one day and says, Brian, where I come from, we have these things called shoes. And Brian goes, what? I've never heard of that. He said, and somebody says, oh yeah, you know, they're like, it's like a piece of, covers the bottom of the foot, and you tie it around, and when you have that on, you can walk about, you know, on the thorns or on the rocks or the dusty road, and your feet won't hurt. Now, if Brian is not a masochist or attached to his suffering, he might say what? It's pretty good. And the next thing he'd say was what? Where can I get some? Right? Don't just say sounds good and go back to, you know, that's like many of us. We go, oh, sounds great. And then we just continue on. Now it's like, oh, I gotta get me one of those. Okay? And I gotta start wearing them. And thus the outer course of things I myself cannot restrain, but let me just restrain my mind and what is left to be restrained. Then he says, recitations, austerities, long though they may prove to be, if practiced with a distracted mind, are futile. So the knower of reality has said. So again, what he's saying, you know, now he's probably speaking to people of his time. He's sort of saying kind of ordinary religious practices, like, you know, reciting mantras or prayers or doing various kinds of austerities. He said, even though, you know, one can do them for a long time, if the mind is distracted, no benefit will come from them. All those who fail to understand the secret of the mind, the greatest of all things, although they wish for joy and sorrow's end, will wander to no purpose, uselessly. One thing about Shanti Devi, he doesn't mince his words. He's many quite strong, but in the beginning of this really wonderful text that really covers the whole path, he says, I wrote this text for myself. To remind me about all the things that I have learned during the course of my years of practice. And he says, and if they might benefit someone else, then I'm happy. But he said, I primarily wrote this as a reminder to myself. Okay. So again, it sort of ties in with the things we've been saying up to now. We need to see the relationship between the meditative practices, the mindfulness, the concentration, the resting the mind, the letting go, learning to let go of thoughts, learning to let go of mind states, learning to let go of stories, either before we go into them or just as we go into them or when we're deep into them, to wake up, to be aware, and to let them go. You know, this is the practice. And over time, we'll get better and better. It's easier and easier. Many people, they say, you know, these mind states, these afflictive mind states, my anger, my fears, my hurts, you know, once they come into my mind, I can't let them go, right? Many people feel powerless. That's not a good feeling, is it? So, and there's no reason to be powerless, right? So this practice of mindfulness and this practice of having a guard at the gate, a guard at the door. It's, you know, if we don't let them in, we don't have to be chasing them around, right? If we never let them in, we don't have to be dealing with the mess they've created. And oftentimes we're sort of on the back end, right? So we want to, over time, develop this mindfulness, okay? So we can catch it much earlier on. where it's much easier to deal with these mind states. And again, you know, we practice this on the cushion, but please practice this, you know, throughout the day here. You know, use this calming, use this centering practice of concentration on an object, on the breath, you know, to clarify the mind. So then, therefore, we can observe what's arising within us with some clarity, no longer any confusion. We can see what's what. We can see what's causing happiness to grow in me and what's causing unhappiness to grow in me. What's causing calmness to grow in me and what's causing agitation to grow in me. And then we can, you know, respond accordingly. But without that guard, without that part of our mind that's kind of watching, it's very difficult. So please, you know, use this day, ideal conditions. We have a couple more days of practice. Today is what? Today is Saturday, Sunday. So we really just have to, but basically we're on a 2-day retreat, which is, again, a good chance for many of us to kind of get a better sense of this practice and get some practice at it. Okay? You know, don't worry if you're not perfect. I always see Sally over here, the pianist. Sally, every time you start a new piece, do you play it perfectly? No? Is it sometime embarrassingly how terrible you play it? Okay. And do you just kind of close the piano and walk away in disgust?
Temporarily.
Well, that's not the answer I wanted. But the truth is what? And eventually that which seems so difficult and sounds so horrible. Yeah, yeah. Slowly, slowly. Yeah, yeah. And slowly, slowly, though, you reach a point where it sounds like something, right? Okay. This is no different. Okay. This is no different. Okay. Good. So we'll stop here and do outdoor walking meditation before lunch.